Good evening to each of you, and greet you again in the precious name of Jesus. Appreciated that devotional. That thought is what gave our Anabaptist forefathers hope as they faced martyrdom. The fact that evil men had control over their body, but they did not have control over their soul. And that's, I think, part of the what Brother Ken was trying to unpack here in a very short time. That evil men can do things to our body, but they can never destroy our soul. Well, thank you as a congregation for putting up with us here today. It's been great being here and rekindling some friendships and growing some friendships and making some new ones, some new faces and new names to try to remember, and I don't always do very good with remembering names, as some of you have probably already figured out. But it's been good to be here, and I thank you for that. And I wish you God's blessing as you serve him and share the gospel here. I don't know how many of you enjoy history. And probably some of you are going, oh no. I'm sorry. I'm not sorry for what I'm going to share. I'm sorry for you. Is that too harsh? I enjoy history. History has a lot to teach us. History has a lot to tell us. And there's a lot we can learn from history. And I would dare say that probably all of us enjoy history to some extent, maybe different facets of it. To those of you who say you don't enjoy history, I venture to guess you have a photo album somewhere. You do enjoy history. Yeah, it's maybe a different facet of it. Some time ago, this was a number of years ago, it stuck in my mind. I think we were coming home from church, and out of the blue, one of my children said, Dad, why do you enjoy history? To those of you that would enjoy history, how do you answer that question? What is it about history that grabs your attention? I thought about that question for a little while. I don't remember how soon I answered it, but I said, you know, it's kind of like being kidnapped, taken away somewhere, placed somewhere. You wake up, maybe the blindfold's taken off of you. What are some questions you're going to start asking? Or maybe you're knocked out and you wake up. You're in the middle of nowhere. You start thinking, where am I? What happened? How did I get here? Now what do I do? Where do I go from here? Isn't that a little bit the way history is? Time is a flowing stream. It's continually flowing. It was flowing upstream before us. We got dropped in the middle of this stream, and it's flowing, and it's flowing. What happened upstream? Where am I here in this stream, and where is this stream going? Another way to look at history. And so to me, it's very helpful to me to understand where I am, to understand where I came from, to help me understand where I'm going. And I think the story of our people is integral to understanding that concept. Yogi Berra once said, if you don't know where you're going, you end up someplace else. He was good for some unique quotes. If you don't know where you're going, you end up someplace else. And I would offer that if you don't know where you came from and if you don't know your story, you may end up a very different place than what you think you will. History is an anchor point, kind of helps us to understand all those questions. One other quote, if you cut the people off from their history, then they can be easily persuaded. If you cut people off from their history, they can be easily persuaded. Does anyone know who said that? Anyone know who the author of that quote is? That was Karl Marx, the famous evolutionist. If you cut people off from their history, they can be easily persuaded. Think about that. The history of your family, your people, is critically important. And tonight I'd like to look at a 100-year section of church history from 1900 to 2000. And you may think that's an awful long time to cover. And yeah, it is a big, There's a lot happened in those 100 years, and we're not going to be able to near look at everything. But this is a story of a spiritual family striving to follow the scriptures and to pass on their way of life, their understanding of scriptural definitions for life, their faith, to their children, their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren, so forth. And historians have studied and evaluated this, and we're going to do a little bit of that this evening. It's an imperfect story because it's made up by people just like you and I. And there is a flawed individual here standing before you this evening trying to understand and grasp some of these lessons and try to understand what they mean for us. And perhaps we would come to different conclusions as we look at this story. But yet, 1900 to 2000, what all happened in that time period, and what does that mean for me today? I'm privileged to be part of this spiritual family. It does for our family, for my family roots, it doesn't go back very far, but several generations. My great-great-grandfather left his Lutheran upbringing to join the Mennonites, and I'm a product of that, and I'm thankful for that. Turn with me to Joshua chapter 4 to start. We won't be in the scriptures a lot necessarily this evening. And I don't want to do the scriptures an injustice necessarily. But again, I do believe history is important. And let's not forget the fact that what you're holding in your hands this evening is a history book. It is full of history. It is full of stories of people. Very flawed people. People that were no better and perhaps no, in some ways, no worse than us. And God saw fit that this story was kept for you and me. So God, can I say from that, can I draw a conclusion from that, that God considers history and stories important? I believe so. Because we're holding the product of that here this evening. Joshua chapter 4. Verse 1, and it came to pass when all the people were clean, passed over Jordan, that the Lord spake unto Joshua, saying, Take you 12 men out of the people, out of every tribe a man, and command you them, saying, Take you hence out of the midst of Jordan, out of the place where the priest's feet stood firm, 12 stones. And ye shall carry them over with you, and leave them in the lodging place where you shall lodge this night. And Joshua called the 12 men whom he had prepared of the children of Israel, out of every tribe a man. Joshua said unto them, Pass over before the ark of the Lord your God into the midst of Jordan, and take ye up every man of you a stone upon his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of the children of Israel, that this may be a sign among you, that when your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, What mean ye by these stones? Then ye shall answer them that the waters of Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord when it passed over Jordan. The waters of Jordan were cut off, and these stones shall be for a memorial unto the children of Israel forever. And the children of Israel did so as Joshua commanded, and took up 12 stones out of the midst of Jordan, as the Lord spake unto Joshua, according to the number of tribes of the children of Israel, and carried them over with them unto the place where they lodged, and laid them down there. Joshua set up 12 stones in the midst of Jordan, in the place where the feet of the priests which bear the Ark of the Covenant stood, and there they are unto this day. Now don't get confused by the unto this day. That was at the time of the writing, whenever this was written, up to that day. Not doesn't mean August 17, 2024. I don't think you're going to find those stones over there anymore. But God saw this story as important, of how he opened up the river so that they could cross over. God saw this story as important, and he wanted them to set up these stones so that the children and grandchildren, perhaps as long as those stones stood, to say, why? Why this? Why that? What's the point of this? What's the point of those stones? And it's to give an opportunity to tell a story. When they shall ask, God saw that as important. Malachi 3:16 says, Then they that feared the Lord spoke often one to another, and the Lord hearkened and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared the Lord and that thought upon his name. A book of remembrance to remembering. What is our story? I believe our story is important. and we need to be telling it, the story of our people. Now, I am from Lancaster County, and so that is my perspective as I look across these lessons of church history from 1900 to 2000. So, because it is not possible to cover them all across North America and South America, wherever our people have been, it's not possible to do that. So I'm somewhat limiting my focus to that. There are lessons to be learned from many other parts of this story, but I will can only speak to the one that's closest to me. And I think a lot of us have connections to that. One of the challenges of history as we study that is to make sure we learn the right lessons. We can study history and we come up with wrong lessons. And that's easy to do. And it's always good to be slightly suspicious of my conclusions of the lessons of history because I could be wrong. And that could keep me from touching a subject like this, but I think we're going to delve into this and see what we can learn. Now there are, I wanted to say at the outset here, two streams of Anabaptist people that we come from. There is the Dutch Mennonites that emigrated over to Poland and then Ukraine, and from Ukraine back to North America, South America, Central America, scattered all over the Americas. That's one stream, and there's at least one family here this evening that I know is connected to that stream. Probably most of us are connected to the Swiss Mennonites, Swiss brethren actually, that would have emigrated from Switzerland. Up, most of them went through Holland and came over to North America here. The story is much, as far as geographically, is much smaller. They didn't travel quite the distance that our Dutch Mennonite brothers did and sisters did. And their story is different, and some of their practices and doctrines were different as well, but we're not going to look at that this evening. So 1900s, U.S. president at the time was William McKinley. The Wright brothers were just beginning to experiment with flying airplanes. That was not that long ago, and in one sense of the word, 124 years ago, the first glider flights from Kitty Hawk were starting to materialize and come together. And I didn't take notice of all the dates of when the first flight was and so forth. It was early 1900s when that would have been. In some ways it seems like a long time ago, and in other ways it doesn't seem like very long at all. Mennonite church scene. Up to that point in America here, most of the Mennonite church and people were all part of the same conference. That's a little hard for us to understand today because we have diverged into multiple different church groups, but pretty much a single denomination up until the late 1800s, with a few exceptions in the middle of that. But in the late 1800s, we have a real divergence happen. We have the mainstream Mennonite church, sometimes called the Old Conference Church, and out of that we have the old orders that left. And this first one was in Ohio and Indiana, the Whistlers. Late 1880s was Ontario. In 1893, Lancaster County, the Jonas Martins people, the Martinites, were sometimes nicknamed the Yonis, if you've ever heard that expression. They came out of that, and then in Virginia was another one. There's various reasons for that, and I'm not going to really spend a lot of time on that. This period following that, the late 1800s, early 1900s, has been called by some the Mennonite Great Awakening. And that's an interesting period. If those of you that enjoy history want to study a period, that's a very fascinating period to study. Because there was a lot of changes happened then. To some, probably more on our side of this, would say a lot of good changes happened. Sunday school, evangelism, missions, a lot of those things happened in the mainstream Mennonite church. The old orders, of course, didn't want that, and so they left in order to keep their way of life. The term Mennonite Great Awakening would lead to believe that apparently there was sleeping beforehand. Was there slumber? Was there spiritual sleep in the church beforehand? It's hard to know exactly where to place all that because I didn't live there at that time. And most of the history writers about that were not from the Old Order people themselves. So who is right on that? Does activity equal spirituality is one question I would ask. So there was a great tempo, an increase in church activity, missions, local missions, foreign missions. Does spirit activity equal spirituality, or does it indicate the opposite or something else? Historian Paul Toews wrote this. He said, "It is not clear that Mennonites needed revival then any more than at other times in the 20th century. But in a religiously based culture, those changes could also be a stylized form to legitimize changes which people did not know how to stop." What he's saying there is, in other words, change can be spiritualized as a means of justifying what somebody wanted to do all along. Okay? You that's what I understand his point being there. Change can be spiritualized to justify what individuals wanted to do all along. Think about that as we look about through some of the changes that our people went through over this period. First thing I'd like to look at is church divisions. For those of you that know history, know your Dutch Mennonite history, there was a period following the persecution in the 1600s when persecution mostly ceased, and a lot of churches, well, some of them had started, I think, actually before that. And one thing I don't want to do here is conflate something which historians at times have done, and that is to equate persecution with peaceable church life. That's not necessarily the case. Sometimes I've heard it said already that, well, if there's persecutions, well, that would end some of our church troubles. No, it wouldn't. It will not. It may intensify them, actually. And you need only look back a few years. Now, COVID-19 and its effects was not persecution. However, it was an impact on our way of life. It was. And we didn't all agree how to address it, did we? We didn't. We had a lot of varying and some very strong opinions on various aspects of that. And I remember working through some of those questions right there at Loyola. I had to try to answer them myself. But we didn't all agree on that. So let's not think that outside pressure brings peace. Church divisions, unfortunately, our story is mirroring that, I believe, of the Dutch Mennonites, and they're split after split after split. We are doing the same thing. We are repeating the same thing. In 1927, we have a very interesting church division, and I want to spend a little bit of time to look at that. But that 1927 is after the old orders had left. This is inside the Old Order Church, 1927. The automobile was coming on the scene. What do we do with this? No one knew what to do with this. What is the automobile? What's it going to do? What should we allow it? Should we not? And this was a difficult thing. Mose Horning was the bishop of the Old Order Church at that point. And he was a little bit of an interesting person. He was prone to faint whenever he faced a stressful situation. The story is told that at his ordination, when it was his turn to go up and take his book, he was unable to stand to his feet. So two men went to help him, at which he promptly collapsed into a faint. And after he regained consciousness, the bishop told him about to go up and get his book, and he said, "I can't." So one of the other officiating ministry opened his book, and the lot was found there in his book. He was, I think, still in his faint, and Bishop Jonas Marnie asked, "What do we do now?" And the deacon said, "Well, ordain him." None of us remember much when the lot fell on us either. So here was this man, and there's multiple incidents like this. At stressful points, he would just faint. And here he is, caught right in the middle of this whole thing. There's probably, I'm not sure what the numbers were, maybe close to half that wanted to accept the car, and close to half that were bitterly opposed to it. And here's this poor man caught in the middle. What's he supposed to do? The main issue was the car. Some wanted it, some did not. Mose tried his best to keep peace and bring people together, but it was unsuccessful. came to a head at conference, and Mose said he will not discipline any members who had the car. And at that point, Joseph Wenger left and took a sizable group with him. You want to read more on that? How many of you have ever read the book Moses on Holy Ground? One, two, few of you. That's a very, it's not written in a historical level at all. It's very much a story form. Very interesting reading. I just stumbled upon the book Original Joe Wenger. It's the story about the other part of this. I do not, have not read that book. But there we have it. We had, so if you go into Lancaster County, you have the Horse and Buggy Mennonites, and you have the Hornings or the Weaverland Conference, and that's the where the history of those two groups. 1968 is another one. These when Eastern would have left conference. The Mennonite Great Awakening had led to a lot of liberalization and divorce and remarriage, cut hair for sisters, worldwide drift in multiple ways was coming into the church, and we have five bishops requesting a release from that that was granted. And it was out of this stream that Pilgrim Conference was formed, what you and I are a part of here. Well, I guess we're still a part of this together, right? For a little bit yet. Well, a little bit more on that later. But those are the two probably most pivotal church divisions, I believe, in this era. And there's a reason why I chose to focus on those two. But you know, I'll get to that in just a little bit. How should we view church divisions? Listen, it's a granted, as I already pointed out, that we will not always agree. And it is unrealistic to expect that we can all stay together in one great, big, happy church conference, I believe. I believe from the standpoint of history, I can say that. And it's also probably right along with that, unrealistic to expect that there will not be church separations without some amount of misgivings, misunderstandings, and hard feelings. And in every one of the church splits I just mentioned, plus numerous others in there, those were all present in some fashion. I'm not excusing that, however, this evening. It is simply recognition of our human frailty. We be but men, and we are prone to repeat those mistakes. I want to remind us and myself this evening, in Luke 9, Jesus said this, and we do well to consider what Jesus told John here in this account, and I won't take time to turn to it. John answered and said, "Master, we saw one casting out devils in thy name, and we forbade him, because he followeth not with us." What did Jesus say? "Forbid them not, for he that is not against us is for us." Let's be careful. Let's be careful. What lessons can we take from the two divisions I mentioned, the Grofdale and the Eastern Division? Well, every Sunday morning, we drive to Leola, right past the Churchtown Mennonite Church, which is one of those churches that was a product of the, I'm not sure when the church was built, actually. But anyhow, one Sunday morning, I meet black cars going into church, and the next Sunday, I meet buggies. And the next Sunday, it's black cars again, and the next Sunday, it's buggies. Now, there's a reason for that, and it blesses me every time I stop to think about it, because these are the two groups that split back in 1927. And they go to church together. Okay, they don't share worship services together. They share the same building. We use it one Sunday, and you use it the next Sunday. And back and forth it goes. And that blesses me when I think about it. Here's two groups of people that couldn't agree on an issue, but they said there's a reasonable way to work this out. Back then, it was common practice that you had church every other Sunday. But they said, okay, well, we're not using the one Sunday. You use it the other Sunday. That blesses me. They could have locked the doors, and there was one instance of that in the earlier and the 1893 division of the door being locked, and that's another story. It's in the negative. I'm going to stay out of that one. But they could have made things difficult for each other. They could have refused to work together. But both sides said, hey, we can work this out. And some of that same attitude was present in the later one. I just want to read a little bit here. This is in the book, Keeping the Trust, that tells the story of the Eastern Division. But I just want to read some account in here that just blessed me. It was not new to me. But after the decision was made that Eastern was going to split away from Lancaster Conference, just a paragraph or two here. So David Thomas was the presiding bishop of Lancaster Conference at that point. And he tells this story. David Thomas, years later, recounted an event that took place when working together with Isaac Sensenig at Myerstown. At one of the meetings about the future of the congregation, an audience member sharply criticized the moderator, Isaac Sensenig, asserting, "Isaac, if you wouldn't have been partial, we wouldn't be in this mess." David Thomas stood up and rebuked him, saying, "You can't talk to my brother like that. We're not here to bring charges. We're here to talk about options." Later, a sister accused David Thomas, the other one, saying, "If you had kept the discipline, we wouldn't be in this mess." And Isaac rebuked her with the same words, "You can't talk to my brother like that." I'll stop reading there. That blesses me that there was a place where, say, we don't agree. Two brothers say we don't agree, but we're going to respect each other and mutually separate. This split has been at times called the amiable schism. There was a dedicated effort by leadership to continue to act as brethren, even though there was a separation coming. After the conference votes to separate, which was approved by 90%, bishops on both sides led in prayer. And one of the prayers was for God to bless and direct both themselves and the others. Now, on a personal level, while there was an effort by leadership to avoid a lot of acrimony and hard feelings, it did not always carry through down further into the congregations. There were some hard feelings there, some broken relationships, unfortunately. But I guess the question, how should we view church divisions? Church divisions are only as painful as we make them. Church divisions are only as painful as we make them. And I'm blessed to be part of a conference that mutually did something like this here just in the spring. We looked at this and said, you know what? We're too big. And it's a little more nuanced than that, but we're too big. We're going to mutually separate. And each build our own churches, operate independently. But we're going to do it as brethren. And I'm blessed that we can do that. We decided to not make this painful, or at least try to make it as painless as possible. May we continue on in that spirit. They're only as painful as we make them. Also, church divisions bring about more congregations. It does. I'm not sure always where to go with that. But I've concluded that maybe it's just the best way we can handle our best way to maneuver through our human tendencies and complications. We don't always agree. And at times there's a point where we can say that we need to say that, well, then let's just mutually separate and build more churches. Because that is a silver lining in the whole thing of church divisions. I was talking to somebody here that was from outside our people, was visiting in one of our churches as a husband and wife, and she asked, forget what her question was. It was something in relation to church splits. I forget how she asked the question. And I replied that I'm not so much embarrassed about all of our church splits over the years. But I'm embarrassed about the attitudes and the hard feelings that resulted from them that I don't believe are necessary. And I don't think they should be part of us as they too often have been. And I'm not trying to judge those that have necessarily have gone before. I'm just saying, what can we learn from this? There will be, Lord willing, most likely, church separations again in the future. What can I do to make them less painful, less hurtful, and bless each other as we choose to go separate ways? Let's take a lesson from that. There are better ways to bring out more congregations, but perhaps that's God's way of making the best out of our human frailty. I believe we can conclude that the level of amiableness in church divisions is very directly connected to two things, and that is the level of humility and pride in those involved. And too often, I believe it's our pride that has spoken or has led the way in some of the attitudes and feelings that were present there. And I am not immune from that myself. Second thing I'd like to look at is simply the automobile. And you say, what? This is an accepted thing. Why look at the automobile? This is not even a point of discussion. No, we're not trying to decide here this evening whether we should drive cars or not, or whether we should go back to buggies. That's not my point. I want us to consider, though, what the automobile has done. A commission appointed by the President of the United States concluded in 1933 that no other invention was diffused so rapidly in American life with such profound and far-reaching consequences as the car. With its speed and automatic mobility, the automobile became the symbol par excellence of modern life. This is a commission appointed by the President of the United States that concluded this. It has made the automobile made dramatic impact on American life and culture. And probably for most of us, that's a little hard to comprehend because we grew up with it. I grew up in driving in a car from as old as I can remember. I never grew up in a horse and buggy or anything like that. That's just all we've ever known. So this came in early 1900s, and as I mentioned, there was a church split because of that. So the question I'd like to ask is, why did the Old Order Mennonites oppose the automobile? Why did the Joe Wangers, in that case, oppose the automobile? And I know it's not good to read a lot, but I just really appreciated the way this writer put it. And this is on gameio.org, if you're familiar with that. The debate over car ownership in Mennonite circles in the first two decades of the 20th century was not an idle one. The car symbolized, now listen to this, the car symbolized individualism, independence, automatic mobility, think automobile, freedom, speed, accelerated lifestyles, leisure, social status, and prestige. Think about that. Such values were a threat to a sectarian subculture that heralded humility, submission, caution, simplicity, modesty, and separation from the world. In other words, it was the anathema to everything they said they stood for. Skipping a few sentences here. Members of old order groups dissatisfied with the slow pace of change would often join a more progressive Mennonite group in order to have a car. In the words of one Amishman, the first thing people do when they leave our church is go out and buy a car. So that is why, part of the reason why they looked at this with such distrust and dislike. And the old order way of life is built around the community. The ability to live in a community and yet worship outside of it, they viewed as a threat. But you know what? We do it all the time. Well, maybe you all don't do it here. But I drive out of my community into another community to go to church. And that was a totally different way of looking at it back in the early 1900s and previously, because the car didn't make that an impossibility. You had to hook up the horse and buggy, and that limited you to how many miles you could go on a Sunday morning, and so you worshiped in your community. And that has impacted us today. You perhaps haven't thought about that, but that has impacted us today. And I'll tell you a story here. Some years ago, a good friend of mine was in our area visiting from out in the Midwestern states, and was with us, I think, Saturday and overnight, Sunday morning, and went with us to church there, Leola, Sunday morning, and came home. We were eating lunch today together, and out of the blue, he just said, Steve, he said, I don't think I could make it in Lancaster County. I don't think I could be a Mennonite, or a Christian, I think is what he said. I don't think I could be a Christian in Lancaster County. And that kind of took me aback for a little bit. I said, what do you mean? What are you referencing? Well, he said, just driving to church, we passed how many churches? And he said, I know there's more around than I saw. So he said, if I'm not happy here, I can go over here. If I'm not happy there, I can go over there. If I'm not happy here, I can go over here. He said, where I live, he said, if I can't make it in my congregation, I have to pick up and move. I pondered that remark many times. The car has enabled us to do that. Sometimes it's easier to leave than to make it work where we're at. And I'm not here to say that there's never a time to do that. I myself have done that. I just want us to think about how much that has impacted our view of church, because church and community at one point were very connected. The church was the center of the community. Now it's almost become an accessory where you pick and choose. When I live in one community but drive out of it to another, there's some things that are lost. The connection between the house of worship and the surrounding community is lost. I do not know many of the neighbors around the Old Mennonite Church because I don't live there. But yet I worship in their community. I don't know them. So when where I live is divorced from my church, from my house of worship, there's a lot less accountability. In other words, I can be a real jerk, I suppose, to my neighbors. If I don't be too big of a stink of it, maybe it won't get all the way over to church. You see what I'm saying? There's a sense where church, being the center of the community, sort of keeps us all accountable to each other. And the automobile has changed that. Now, maybe you're thinking I'm going to encourage us all to go back to driving horse and buggies. No, I'm not going to do that. But I do want us to think about one thing, and this is the reason I chose to look at the automobile as one of these issues. It is strikingly similar in many ways to something else that we deal with today, and that is electronic technology, our phones. Our phones are doing all those things to the next level. You don't even have to leave your home now. You can just worship from your house. You can just do it from your phone. Don't feel like going to prayer meeting? Fine, pick up your phone and call in, right? It's so handy. And I know that you could do that to a limited aspect before we had phones and some of that technology. Or the unlimited availability of sermons online and podcasts and all the things we can feed on throughout the week. And that may not be necessarily wrong, but there are disconnecting us, feeding the individual aspect of our humanity, and, sort of disconnecting us from our church family at some level, because I don't need to go to church to get my cup filled. When I get to church Sunday morning, it's already full from everything I've used my phone on throughout the week. Let's not let that get in between us. That's where a lot of American culture is today. That's why there's a lot of churches up for sale, because it's no longer worth the effort and aggravation to go to church. You can just do it from home because technology has made that so convenient. Beware what the phone is doing to us in that regards. And there's, other aspects of that, but I think it is breaking down our concept of church and brotherhood in the community. Well, there was three different responses to the automobile. There was a group that said, we'll take the car no restrictions. It's great, it's fine. And it became one of the pieces that took them right out into the world eventually. There was a group that said, we will take none of the car. The Amish totally rejected it, the Joe Wengers totally rejected it, but eventually had to come somewhat to terms with at least using it to a greater or lesser extent. And there was a third group that said, let's use this, but let's be careful. Let's set some guidelines in place so that it does not disrupt our way of life. It could be used for good because we can take the gospel to much more distant places than we could before, and all that is well and good. So there's a sense of using it in a good way. And I think the same thing needs to apply to us as we consider electronic technology, that we need to be careful with it. It can do some very harmful things to us, but it can also be used to promulgate the gospel in many, many ways that was previously unheard of. Our website gets hits from all over the globe. We can spread the gospel to a large extent with that. Let's be careful that we can keep our spiritual family story going. Next one I'd like to look at is the battle for the non-resistant faith. Read just another account here, and there's many stories from our people's past on this subject. I had to hit him, insisted Sergeant John Points Dexter at the court-martial trial of George S. Miller, a Mennonite draftee. I hit him because he said, God damn the stars and stripes. And this led to an altercation where Mr. Miller's nose was broken and he was bleeding and beaten up. But he refused to fight. I'm skipping over a few things here for the sake of time. On the night of August 28, he and three other conscientious objectors had received the scrubbing and tubbing treatment. Zealous soldiers, not officers, had scratched them raw with brooms under a cold shower. A Mennonite leader who later saw Miller in the guardhouse reported that the treatment had just peeled the outer skin off until in some places he looked like a piece of raw meat. Faced with such hazings, Miller's companions had agreed to wear the military uniform. But Miller had refused and kept refusing even after his tormentors dunked his head repeatedly into a tub of water. From prison, Miller wrote letters expressing both spiritual submission to suffering and a great desire for freedom. On one hand, he wrote that it has become a glory to me that I could be counted worthy of the suffering and shame for the cause of Christ. On the other hand, he said sounds from outside the prison walls had made him yearn for freedom. And so on. I don't know what that is. I don't. My generation knows nothing about the draft, or the methods of treatment, physical treatment, almost torture that some of our young men in previous generations did. And it is very easy in a time, I believe, of extended peace to start beginning to lose that in little ways, almost unaware. We've come to expect that our government will continue to carve out exceptions for our young men and middle-aged men. And I hope and pray that they will, but I also am aware of the fact that that likely will not continue. How long, I'm not going to make any predictions on that, but I believe our faith will likely again be tested on this issue. The non-resistant faith. I never cared for I shouldn't say never, but in recent years I've felt like the term non-resistant really is an unfair or incorrect way of describing what I believe Jesus was teaching us. So you can come up here and slap me, or somebody can walk up to you and slap you, and you can grit your teeth and refuse to fight back, or refuse to hit back, and walk away hoping that somebody slaps him good and proper and teaches him a thing or two. That's not the non-resistant teaching that Jesus was giving. And that word non-resistant kind of implies to me that as long as we don't hit back, we followed the commandments of Jesus. We have not. Jesus said, don't just not hit back. Show them love. Go the second mile. If they take your coat, you give them your cloak also. We don't fight with carnal weapons. We fight with love. It's a battle and a weapon that the carnal man knows nothing about. This fight has a purpose. The purpose is to help the sinner, help the man that is hitting you, or whatever way he's abusing you, to help him see that there is a better way. And by simply stoically accepting it and walking away, you're not teaching him much. We fight with love. We show him love. We go the second mile to show him love no matter what he has done to me. That is the purpose. Our non-resistant faith is not just, it's not just simply not fighting, but it's an effort to show love, to convert a soul. Let's not forget that. This is an action. Non-resistance, if you want to call it that, is a faith in action. It's doing something good in response for the evil. We hope to redeem his soul. Of course, we can all think of the account of the Anabaptist who went across the water, across the ice, pursued by someone who wanted to do him harm, and his pursuer fell through the ice, and he went back to help him out, to help him back out of the water. That's the type of redemptive love, is which I prefer to call it, that Jesus is asking for us. The battle for the non-resistant or redemptive love, that we, in our time of peace, our years of peace, I'm afraid perhaps we're not as strong, near as strong on this, and I'm talking to myself too, because I've not experienced this. We're perhaps maybe not nearly as strong on this as we should be. And I often think about that when I'm out on the road and someone cuts me off, and how quickly I want to forget that. Go tailgate him for a while and teach him a thing or two. Lord, help us to practice that and live that out daily in our daily life so that we're prepared for the real tests when they come. World War II, there was four drafts between 1900 and 2000. World War II was the first one, and Mennonite Church was pretty much unprepared to face that one. Number of stories from that. One interesting observation from the chairman of the Board of Inquiry. This is the board that would interview COs, conscientious objectors. He wrote this. He contemptuously referred to the Mennonites as ignorant and lethargic. He wrote that civilization apparently has passed them by. They remain a curious and alien survival of an old world people, an anachronism amid the life of today. Ignorant and lethargic was his terminology. One military intelligence report stated that, as farmers, the Mennonites are 100% efficient, as militants, 100% deficient. I suppose he meant that as an insult. I read that and thought, well, that's a compliment. I take that as a strong compliment. That in fighting, we're worthless. That's how we should be. There were some Hutterites that were horribly treated in that time period. They were treated to the point that all four of them died from that. The military officials in charge had sent their bodies home in military uniforms. Now, they had rejected and died on the principle of refusing to wear that uniform. And apparently, in an insult, the military officers dressed them in military uniforms and sent them home. I would ask the question, who are the cowards? Who are the cowards? Those that would abuse defenseless men, or those that chose to suffer for a faith that would not hit back, that would try to love instead? Who were the cowards? World War I, brought the Mennonites to an identity. Who are we really? What do we believe? What are we willing to die for? One writer put it this way. He said they could not get a secure hold on their American citizenship without loosening their grip on that other citizenship, which mattered even more, their place in the kingdom of Christ. It was to they saw it as one or the other. If we put on the uniform, pick up the gun, we've left the one kingdom for the other one. God help us if, when that time comes, that we would be willing to take the same stand, that I would be willing to take the same stand, even in spite of treatment like that. World War II was a second draft. The Korean War was the third draft. The Vietnam War was the fourth draft. And there was multiple stories that could be shared throughout all that. Skipping over a few things here. Just remember, non-resistance is not a doctrine only for wartime. It seems that if we're not willing to share the love of Jesus today with those that would be unkind to us in various ways, I don't think we're going to be ready to face the serious questions. It's something to consider. Are we willing? Can we share love with those that would do us wrong, those that would insult us? The larger the group, thinking of CO status, is the larger the group asking the government for CO status, the more likelihood of it being accepted. And I want us to think about that because there is a growing movement amongst the Anabaptist peoples to have independent congregations outside of a conference or a wider body. And I understand why that is, and I'm not saying that is wrong. However, if a draft should come again, those are going to be in a difficult place, I fear. Because generally, the larger the group, the more attention the government has been willing to pay to those requesting CO status. So consider that carefully. And I do, again, like I said, I do believe the time will come when these questions will come at us. Well, very quickly, higher education, just spend a few minutes here. One of the other challenges that our people have faced in this time period, there were multiple efforts put towards higher education. Let's do it ourselves. The colleges and universities of the mid-1900s were faced with a lot of modernistic evolutionary teaching, and credit to those that wanted to take their youth out of that and put them into a better school of higher education. Unfortunately, they had no way of knowing that what it would produce, and that has failed pretty much every time it was tried. That's a simple conclusion, I think, that most historians would agree on. As far as preserving our Mennonite way of life, higher education has failed to do that, and has actually done the opposite. What's a lot more difficult to understand is why higher education has failed. And I would offer up three things here for you to consider as why higher education has failed in the past. And I'm not saying there's not a way to do this. I know there's been some more experimentation with that here in more recent years. And I'm watching this interestingly to see what becomes of this and where it goes. But here's a couple things. So we have students going to school, going to college, university, and they're hearing one thing from their teacher and they're hearing a different thing from their pastor at their church. One thing from one and a different thing from the other, because the schools were independent of the churches for the most part. Now, or at least it eventually became that way. Not all of them started that way, but it's where they eventually became, and it came to the point where students heard one thing at school and they heard a different thing at church. Which are you going to follow? Well, put yourself back in your mind back when you were youth. Which one would you follow? One that felt better and the one that sounded better, that fit what you wanted to do. So that was one thing, a mixed message that soon crept in there. And right along with that, a tension between church and the school that was always, nearly always present, this tension. And it's almost a battle for the young person. Who gets this young person, the church or the school? And the youth felt this. Number three, our heritage has always been a simple lifestyle. And there's something about higher education that militates against a simple Bible faith. When we have to have a logic and an explanation and a study for everything and to try to understand everything, it militates against a simple Bible faith. Now, I am not against higher education per se. I believe there is one of the blessings of electronic technology is if our sisters want to get into nursing, and I believe that is a good thing. You could, instead of going to college to get the credits you need for that, you can do it from home. You can study from home online to do that, and that's one of the blessings of that. I'm sorry. Well, also, another of the reasons why it failed is simply because of accreditation. I missed that earlier. The state said you had to teach this, and this to get a certain credits. And so to fit that program, the schools would modify some of their curriculum to meet what the state required. So who was really running the school, the state or the church? So that's another piece of that tension that was there. Those are a few of lessons from the 1900 to 2000 church history period. There are many more. I glossed over a few of the bigger ones, the ones that have interested me. There are many more that could be learned. And for those of you that enjoy history, and for those of you that should enjoy history, I challenge you to do some of the study yourself. You'll probably get more of that than you did listening to me, perhaps. But perhaps I've whetted your appetite for that. History of our spiritual family in the 20th century is a history about how we related to change. How do we relate to change? And changes haven't stopped coming, have they? And they won't. Changes will continue to come. How are we going to face the challenge of change today? Are we willing to do the work to maintain our historic faith? Or will we allow the winds of change to drive us off course and take our children away from the heritage that should be theirs? Be careful. Change is inevitable. It is. What do we do with it? Trust that these few thoughts tonight could again inspire us to continue the vision, to continue the faith that our forefathers had and what they gave to us. And I'm blessed, again, as I said at the beginning, to be a part of this family of faith. Thank you again for allowing us to come and spend some time here with you all. It's been good to be here and learn to know some of you better. So let's kneel for prayer yet.